Welcome to That Creator Life, a show where we discuss the process, the struggles, and the wins of content creation. My name is Zach. I'm a YouTuber and content strategist helping you start your journey. Hey guys, welcome to a new episode of the Content Creator Life. Today is a special episode because we're outside, outdoors, on the rooftop, and we also have a very special guest, friend of mine, J.K. Hobson. How you doing, man?
Doing great, man. This feels good to be very special. It's just that kind of day.
Yeah, you are. And you are the first comic on this show, so that's also a special thing.
Yeah, I guess if you're doing a podcast, you got to get a comic on at some point.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like, we were talking before the podcast, as somebody who is a stand-up comic, is the height of creative content creation, especially stand-up comic.
That's insane, man, because I've heard it also referred to as the lowest form of art.
Really?
I mean, I think at its best, it can be great. There's a lot of trash that goes on a stage, especially at an open mic, but it's cool to be regarded that way. So thank you. And thank you for having me on, man.
It's a pleasure, JK. So can you tell us about yourself and how did you start your content creation?
I started out doing content as a musician in New York City. I grew up in New York City, and in high school, I got into playing guitar and really enjoyed that. I started doing comic books. I used to be an artist, visual artist, and then I found it wasn't as gratifying for me. Once I started playing music, I found that there was more instant gratification, which I really got into, just making music and performing live. That's really where I get a lot of energy from. It's different from drawing something and then trying to get somebody to just look at it. And then maybe somebody looks at it, maybe somebody recognizes it. Something about music, it's also really physical, kinetic. So I was in the metal scene and hardcore scene in New York, and I played in a bunch of bands. I played guitar, I played drums, played bass, I sang for different bands. But that was my, the original content that I was into. But I was always into stand-up. Even as a kid, I was into Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy when he came out, was just mind-blowing. In my 20s, I hit a wall. I had some real serious mental health struggles, and I got really depressed at one point for a long time, for a bunch of months. And it was really hard for me to get out of it. New York is an interesting place to be depressed, because one thing about depression, if you don't realize you're depressed, you just project your bullshit onto everybody else. And if you're depressed in New York, everybody looks miserable. So you're just look at all these miserable people around. Everybody's so lonely, and not realizing it's you. Yeah, subway especially. So everybody reads books. You have to look at everybody's depressed faces. And I discovered this comedian, Bill Hicks. And I discovered him because of a Tool album. He's a comic that was, I would say, popular, but he never hit the mainstream because his comedy was just so controversial. He talked about politics and religion, and drug use. He was kind of like George Carlin, but even more hardcore, if you can believe that. But to the point that he got actually banned. He got blacklisted in the U.S. He told this joke. He said, you think if Jesus ever comes back, he's going to ever want to see another cross? Isn't that going up to Jackie Onassis with a rifle pendant? But something about hearing him really lifted my spirits, and it helped me to laugh at things that were just so depressing and so dark. So it did something and really shaped my persona and really changed my outlook on life. And after that, I got into a really successful band, it's successful for underground metal. When we got signed, ooh, there we go. We're out in nature, people. You can hear it. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it is. It is. It's nice to hear, actually. But so I got into this band, and we had a pretty successful career. We moved to LA, got signed, did a bunch of touring, and then we broke up suddenly. And when we broke up, I didn't really know what to do for a while. So I went back to school, did really well in school, moved to Vietnam on a Fulbright scholarship. But while I was in school, I tried stand-up a couple of times, and I really enjoyed the writing of it, and especially enjoyed that it was a really direct expression of how I really felt about things. When you're doing music, you can mean one thing and people interpret it a totally different way. It's a lot harder to do with stand-up. Also with music, you need at least the music I want to do, you need at least two or three or even four other people in order to do it. Whereas with stand-up, it's like your own energy, your own drive. It's just you and a mic. So I really like, especially coming out of music and the way that my career ended was just so disillusioned. So just being able to just show up at a place and just get on a mic, it's very do-it-yourself kind of thing. That really appealed to me. So I did it a couple of times in college. And then when I came here on the Fulbright, after I finished and decided to stay in Saigon, I saw some of the comedians that were doing comedy here. And I was like, oh, I think I can do that. And that was about almost 5 years ago. And I've been doing it very regularly ever since, including putting my own shows together. Now I host shows, I MC, I get weird kinds of odd jobs, like I MC'd a wedding last month at Saigon Outcast. I've got some international comedians coming in, which is cool. Like people that I've been fans of for longer than I've been doing stand-up are going to be coming into town because I'm putting together shows for them. So it's like really weird, but it's good, man. So that's the really truncated, like short version of, yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Moving on, what?
Stand-up comedy.
Yeah, which is like, so it's funny that the funny thing about content, when you're doing stand-up, you don't want to, I have these jokes, and these jokes like have a value, but it's very different from the value of, say, a song. You have a song and somebody listens to it, they're like, oh, that's dope. I want to hear that again. I want to see that live. And so people will come and see it and, oh, you're going to play this song. Oh, thank you for playing this song. And so people want to hear it again and again. The marginal utility of a joke is like very low. Once you've heard it once, it drops. So I tend not to put out a lot of, once in a while I'll post stuff just like jokes. If once you hear a joke one time, some people want to hear them again and again. I get surprised. Sometimes somebody goes, oh, are you going to do this joke? Some people like to hear it again and again. But I think for the most part, I think a lot of comedians, some comedians like myself, tend not to post too much of our stuff. Because then what are you going to listen to when you come to the show? So it's like constantly having to write new stuff. Usually just something strikes me as funny. Something strikes me as like odd. And especially if it's something that no one has ever said before. That's like the key, is if you can find something that really resonates with people as being true, but has never been said before, that's where the explosion happens. Something surprising, but at the same time resonates as true. And sometimes I'll just say something that's shocking or, oh, nobody would expect that. But if it can be based in something that's true, especially I talk a lot about social issues, political issues, because that's when I talked about that comedian, Bill Hicks, he talked about really controversial topics and was doing it sometimes in front of people that didn't necessarily think the same way as he did until they heard it being said. A lot of people talk about comedy as being a vehicle for social change. Like I'm not sitting here going, oh, I'm going to change society with this joke. But my brain is wired that way. It still has to be funny. That's the key. So I'll have a thought of something that is funny or something even that's interesting. The premise has to be interesting. So for example, yeah, actually.
What I heard Joe Rogan say about. Also. Life.
Yeah.
Have to do something. It just has to be it.
Sure.
Most people don't want to talk about.
Right.
Don't really have a way to express.
It can also be something really mundane. You know what I mean? Like something that everybody sees, but it doesn't register like immediately. Or something that has a little bit of depth or something that has like political resonance. I have a joke about, I've got this buddy named Tom. The older Vietnamese dude. And he's one of these guys that like, he just loves American people, but always talks shit about Vietnamese people. It was weird. So I asked him if it was okay if I call him Uncle Tom. And he said it was okay. But Tom did the most Vietnamese thing I had ever seen him do, which we were at a Circle K. And there was a bunch of people standing in line. And he skipped in front of the line like nobody was there and put his beer on the counter and started, which is something that people do in Vietnam. People just skip. And that's like my pet peeve. So we got outside. I was like, hey, Tom, why'd you skip all those people in line? Don't you have any respect for queuing? He goes, you know what, JK? I waited in line once in 1975. And I missed a very fucking important helicopter ride. So you know what? I ain't doing that shit no more. It's a made up story. But the beginning of that joke was that I was getting really annoyed that people skip you in line all the time. You know what I mean? It's not even you're not paying attention. Some old lady would just elbow her way in. You know what I mean? And so then I was like, why is this happening all the time? But I started thinking about, is expecting people to wait in line, is that a form of like cultural imperialism? If people are not used to waiting, this is how we do things where I'm from.
Yeah.
I expect that you do that. So I started thinking of it that way. And then it was like, oh, that's okay.
Not like a...
No.
It's like a... Probably...
Totally. Just has a different way of doing things. Yeah, you're not paying. If you were paying attention, I wouldn't have been able to do this. Oh, you're sitting on your phone. Obviously, you're not in a rush. I'm in a rush. So I think
I had a problem with this. Never
sure, of course.
But it took me just like 2 months to change my mind about it. Sometimes.
Yeah, or sometimes I'll just give them a look. I literally had a monk try to skip me in line in the Mekong Delta. And I just looked at him like, yo. Namaste, but not today, buddy. Like, I got shit to do too. You know what I mean? But the point is, I think that a lot of, especially expat comedians, come to Vietnam and they just want to make jokes about, oh, isn't Vietnam weird? Isn't this weird how they do things? Because they're catering to other expats. So it's like an easy sell. Whereas sometimes what I try to do is try to understand what's happening here culturally and frame it in such a way that when I do voices for Vietnamese people, like in my jokes, I don't sit there and imitate a Vietnamese accent. What I'll do is I'll just say it like how I say it. And that way, for some reason, it becomes more palatable. So I'm trying to really understand the place where I'm at and my place in it and not the fact that these things are different. Like, why are they different? It probably has to do with my educational background. I'm in global studies. It's all about trying to find the common denominators that exist between people. So that's the angle where I come from. And again, it's not like I'm sitting here purposely trying to do it. It's just, that's how my brain works. If I'm doing something else, if I'm like making fun of just, oh, people here are so weird, it feels cheap to me. And that's not where I'm coming from.
Well.
You know, and people do the other thing all the time. That's just what I do. You know, people.
Especially.
People seem to like it. Yeah, thanks, man.
Hey, move on talking about, let's say you have a thought. This stuff I like to talk about. It's part of the thing asking about this question.
Comedian.
So, yeah, and I think
for me, for stand-up, it doesn't happen in isolation. Because sometimes what I used to do was just like sit in front of my laptop and try to think of something funny. You know, let me think of something funny. Here we go. And then here's, come on, funny bone, start getting tickled. But what actually ends up happening is when I'm out and about and I'm talking to somebody, I'll be talking to my girlfriend, I'll be talking to my friends, or I'm talking to other comics, or even students, something will strike me as being hilarious about it. And especially sometimes it's something that I can't laugh at in the moment. It's just something that stands out about this moment. This is really funny. So then I write a note to myself. That's the premise. It's not necessarily a joke. It's just the premise. There's something funny about this. And hopefully I have enough time to write it out where it makes sense when I read it later on. Because sometimes I'll read this thing and I'm just like, I don't understand what's so funny about this. Either that, either the moment, it was funny in the moment, or it was funny in the moment, but I didn't articulate it well enough when I wrote it down to really get the nuances of it. So I basically have a Google Doc with all these premises. And then later, so then a content creation day, when I'm creating content off stage, so this is, I think, like a more technical push, is that I'll go through those premises and I'll be like, okay, let me see what's funny about that. And then sometimes, especially when I was first starting, I would try to write it out as a joke, type it out word for word. Nowadays, if I'm being honest, I don't sit down and write that much. I don't write jokes that much. What I'll do is, so I have an open mic that I do every Monday at Indica here in Saigon. An open mic is basically where comedians come to try out new jokes. I didn't always host it. Now I'm the host and I'm the MC. But the open mic has always been central to the creation of my content, which is basically, okay, I have these thoughts. And sometimes I'll have brainstorm like the premise, but then while I'm talking to the audience, I'm finding out what is it that really works about this joke? What is it? Because at the end of the day, you can sit home and write jokes, because all of my jokes, when I'm sitting at home writing them, they are fucking hilarious. Like the audience in my mind is just dying, but I am not the audience. You know what I'm saying? It's okay. Maybe ideally, if I had a room full of like 100 people that thought the way that I did, they'd be dying. But there's a baseline. There's a thing that we find collectively funny, or enough of us find collectively funny, that will manifest as an acceptable amount of laughter. And the only place you can find that out is in front of people. So it is live creation. And then I'll record it, go back and listen to it. Oh, okay, what really worked? And then I got to figure out how to economize it, like how to say the funny thing, like not only in the least amount of words possible, but in a way that's rhythmically appealing. That's just me. Other people have people do one-liners, or some people tell long stories. I think because I come from a music background, that I wanted to have like rhythm, and I will sit there and take a sentence and say it in this way. I'll tell you the punchline for one of my new jokes is, I felt bad sitting there watching her scroll through Spotify trying to find a non-existent collaboration between Cardi B and Bill Cosby. Right. And it was like the non-existent collaboration between Cardi B and Bill Cosby. It's almost like a drum roll. That's the punchline. You'd have to hear the entire joke to know why that's funny. But I had to sit there and figure out, like, who am I going to use as the references for this punchline? And what is the rhythm that's going to sound the most like rhythmic? Because something about that also makes people laugh. So some of that you figure out live, and then off stage, you tighten it up. So yeah, it's a communal, it is something that doesn't happen in isolation. I think even musicians write at home and then they just play it. And maybe it's closest to jazz music. Improvisational jazz music is maybe the closest thing music-wise to stand-up comedy. Yeah. But that's pretty much what it looks like. Seeing what works, doing that again, seeing what doesn't work. Try it like 3 times, because sometimes I'll think it's really funny. It's, oh, I got to try it again. Sometimes there are jokes that I've written that didn't work, and I just had to figure out. It's like a puzzle. Like, I know this is funny, but I got to find the way to make it work. So some jokes that I did years ago that never worked, I revamped later on, and now they work. So it's a long process.
When it comes to those days, have you ever felt that you're not in the... down, not at the, you might have it, you need to.
Yeah, you got to do it. It's just nothing. It's like
is
muscle memory.
You do right now, not having it. For example, like for me,
it's a great example. Problem. Yeah.
Talking about, but for him.
Oh, sure.
What's that think for you?
I'm pretty lucky in the sense that I run this open mic every week, which has been going on for as long as I've lived here. This open mic has existed. It's been in different places. It was at Indica, then it was at Lou Bar for a little while. These are different locations in Saigon. But I have a responsibility to be there and to host for these other comedians to come on stage. I provide the space for comedians to come out and try their stuff. So it's a responsibility that it's not just me. It's a responsibility I have to the comedy community. And within that space, I get a lot of stage time. There are definitely days that I don't want to do it. It's on Monday night. So it's like the first day of my work week. You know what I'm saying? It's my hardest day that I have at work, which is I teach global perspectives at an international school. My first two classes that I teach are my toughest classes of the entire week. And luckily I have enough time to go home and chant. I have a Buddhist practice, which is I chant Nam-myoho Renge Kyo so that I can get like, yeah. But the fact that it's a responsibility, I have accountability to these other comedians and to the comedy scene. So that really, when it's a thing of, it's not just up to me, it's, and not to say it's not a job, but again, it's a responsibility. So that keeps me going, because when I wasn't doing that, I would sometimes spend, if I wasn't in the mood, I would spend weeks away from the mic, or there were times I didn't do shows for a month. Because when I've said this on other podcasts, the way that I would feel about stand-up comedy was largely dependent on what happened the last time I did stand-up comedy. So if I bombed, I was like, I don't want to get up in front of people for like weeks. Or if I did really well, it's, oh, okay, great. I'll ride that high for a while. But now it's something like I'm just doing and doing. So I'm on stage. If I have a show, especially, I'll be on stage. I'll have like more than an hour of stage time per week. And that becomes like muscle memory, being used to being in front of people, feeling comfortable in front of people. I've had like recent shifts in my perspective about audiences and who they are and how I relate to them, that it's just come from being on stage a lot, that level of comfort. Yeah, but for somebody who doesn't have that kind of responsibility, it's not about if you're leaving it up to your mood, like when you're going to create content, when you're going to do this thing, then it's going to be a slow roll. It's going to be stop and go. It's got to be something you do as a part of your rhythm, like eating breakfast or working out or breathing.
Talking about bombing, the question about feedback. So basically, any company out there, we're all good with it. Comedy, but I feel you have the outside sometimes. Part within you. Question is how?
Yeah. I've had negative feedback on my jokes, like that. Oh, they were either insensitive or they were not inclusive of this group or another group. And people think that comedians are just going up there making fun of things, and maybe that we're insensitive people. And that's not always really. Sometimes I don't want to marginalize anybody. You know what I mean? A lot of people argue about the punching up versus punching down. I don't really get like toxic, but just sometimes people will just not. I've had some jokes that people were like, oh, this isn't fair, or this is, you know, the first thing I'm concerned about is it being funny. But at the same time, I don't want to tell jokes that would make somebody from an already marginalized community feel bad or more marginalized, because I don't enjoy that. So there's that kind of feedback, which if it's there are jokes that I just don't do anymore, because I'm like, oh, okay, wow, that's either that's messed up or that could, because you know, once a joke leaves, it takes a life of its own. And I don't want to tell the kind of joke that somebody else would use, like in a not funny way.
It's happened a lot.
Sure. So that's my line. Not everybody has that line. So there's that kind of, and sometimes that feedback, if I think it's ridiculous, I will summarily ignore it. Or I've even had feedback end up as a part of the joke. There was a joke. Yeah. One of the jokes involved somebody complaining about my use of the C word.
Oh.
And by the C word, by the way, I don't mean the C word that is referring to a woman's genitalia, the other C word. Yeah, they were like, oh, are you allowed to use that? And I was like, eh. So anyway, without going into too much detail, the most negative feedback is either A, getting heckled in the moment. Yeah, that's happened. I've had situations where I've had to just shut somebody down, which is fun when it works out because they can actually help you. But I've had other things. I was doing a charity event at Outkast and somebody yelled something out and it was like, where I was like, I had to stop myself. And I told the dude, I wasn't on stage right now. I come down and smack the shit out of you. So here's the thing. It's not to sound like people will say things to you when you're at work or when you're on stage because they know that you're working because they think they can get away with it. So there's that kind of negative feedback. But the other thing is just like people not laughing, like bombing. And that when it first happens, it's excruciating, especially you got to do your time. You got to be up there for 10, 12, 15 minutes. And so it's just at this point, I've done this so much. You kind of die inside and you just get through. You just go back to the material, just rely on the material. A lot of comedians, when they get a negative response, they will veer towards blaming the audience. It's just like, oh, this audience is this, is that. I feel like that's not something that really helps you because if you're blaming the audience, there's nothing that you can do to improve but say, I was in front of the wrong people at the wrong time. So just like a baker wouldn't make shitty cakes over and over again and have people complain and say, oh, these people don't have good taste in cakes. If something I'm doing is not working, then I have to be introspective and I got to say, okay, what is it? Why is this not working? What do I got to do differently?
Man, I believe having feedback face-to-face is usually very different from the one you get online.
Yeah.
Even the content.
Yes. People online, people will say messed up things or that's not even comedy. Like I said, I don't post a lot of comedy online and the people that I share with are usually in my social network. I do have my public page. I've gotten specific incidents of negative feedback. Yeah, I think when it first happens, it can throw you for a loop because sometimes it can validate like every negative thought that you've ever had about yourself and undermine your sense of self-confidence. But like the great Cat Williams said, it's self-confidence. So it's not for anybody else to determine. So if you're doing this, it does require a strong sense of self and determination. I practice a form of Buddhism that really highlights the fact that happiness is something that comes from within and it's not dependent on your circumstances. So when I shift that perspective to talking about content creation, though to a degree, when I'm performing live, what I'm doing, it matters what the audience thinks, but something like that, it's not going to make everybody happy. And somebody who's making a comment online, that's one person. If they're in an audience and they don't laugh, that's still what matters is what most people think. For this specific thing that I'm doing, yeah, but most it requires some introspection. The thing is, if it's true, if there's something that you need to do better, then you can take that for what it is. If somebody's making a valid criticism, then yeah, maybe take it and try to apply it to what you do next. Don't sit there and beat yourself up for it. Oh, I'm terrible because I didn't do this thing that this person didn't like, or I did this thing that this person didn't. If there's something you can take, you can extract from it that's valuable, then take it and apply it to the next thing. If it's somebody just being a troll, and sometimes it's hard to leave that stuff alone. When I was in the band and people would make, I would like scroll through the comment section looking for bad things that people were saying because it just fed some kind of like self-hating monster inside of me. But now I just let it roll off my shoulders. The thing about like bombing though is like people just like not responding whatsoever. And again, it gets easier with time. Like once you have faith in your material, you're going to have off nights now and again. Just don't let it throw you into a tailspin where you don't perform for weeks at a time as I've done in the past. Just get back on next time you can.
Even with that, you said like, for example, different things, overcome it or at least get back the big,
yeah,
where you eat. On or some level that you want.
It's a constant. It never ends. Even the state of Buddhahood, which I practice Nichiren Buddhism, which is a little different from other forms of Buddhism, where basically you're like working your way over lifetimes to attain a state of Buddhahood. It's like you're climbing up a ladder. You know, in Nichiren Buddhism, there are 10 states of life that we live in at every moment of the day, one of 10 states. And one of them is Buddhahood, and it's attainable in this lifetime, but it also changes from moment to moment. That you can be in this state for a little while and be like, hey, I got it. Oh my God, I'm the shit. And next thing you're falling back down the ladder again. So it's a constant leveling up. It's constantly engaging with different moments. The thing that I really enjoy about my practice, you're talking about a baseline, is that it helps me to raise my baseline. People have a state of happiness or unhappiness that they tend to float at, return back to. That's like their like baseline, as you put it. But the practice of Buddhism has helped me to raise that. And to raise it so that even when things are difficult, I bounce back much quicker than otherwise to try to extract value from it and see what can I do with it and get back to that state.
I like what Tony wrote. And every time it can get faster about that.
Sure.
It take you like to get back. And then one, it even can go maybe just on that one.
That's it. So it's just a change of your mindset. Our minds can think like thousands of things in a minute. And though all those things that we think have a direct impact on how we experience the world looks totally differently from somebody who is feeling confident and connected to someone who's not. If you're not, the world is just full of enemies and people trying to get in your way. So it's a scary place. Whereas when you're confident, even those scary times, you have the sense that you are in charge of your destiny, that the things you do matter and that you can create the life that you're living in.
There's one thing that a lot of writers and especially comedians struggle from, and I do as well, which is the imposters.
Impulse,
the stress,
the imposter syndrome. Oh, yeah, okay. Sure.
Have you ever had that? It's a big one, right?
Yeah. Sometimes it'll hit me. I'm about to go on stage in front of a bunch of people I don't know. I don't know how this is going to go. Am I a comedian? Like, what? And all kinds of anxiety. Again, my Buddhist practice really helps a lot with that, which is that I'm floating through life, these series of moments, but everything has led me to this one. So this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. And so if you're thinking you're in a situation that, I don't deserve it. I'm over my head. You know what? Here you are. So you better make something of it.
You're already there. You're not thinking about it.
And you're here because of something that you've done or something that you've thought or something that you've said. All these consecutive moments of your life have brought you to this moment. So this is where you're supposed to be. Now you can choose to do it.
Quit.
Or you can choose to say, this is not me and freak out. I always say it's better to regret something you have done than to regret something you haven't done. Shout out to the Butthole Surfers right away, by the way. That's where I got that from. Go check out Butthole Surfers, Sweat Loaf. Amazing, inspirational song. But it's a gift, like where you are in this moment. And we're not always feeling 100%. But again, just like with creating content, can't wait to feel the way. Life is not about, when I get to this place, then I'm going to have the strength to do this.
Or things that have to work perfectly.
Because it might
be perfect is what we're doing now, podcast. We had to change location 2 times because circumstances, outdoor experience, but then dream, cannot blame the weather, but we have to do it. So find another way.
If we move one more time, I'm leaving in the middle of the podcast.
Yeah,
I will not continue. I'm going to quit.
I don't know what else would happen here.
Maybe. No, we're cool, man. There's a great quote talking about this. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, do the thing and you will have the power. Okay, it's not, when I get to this point, like when you take the action, that's how you get the strength. That's how you get the courage. Another one is courage is not just being brave. courage is being afraid and doing the thing anyway. And that's how you develop courage. That's how you develop this sense of strength, is through overcoming the challenges, not through not having challenges, through overcoming them and saying, I did that shit.
Have you ever had anybody which I believe is also.
Yeah. I have had another thing too, which is like, that I'm struggling with now, which is that there's this whole, like, the enemy of my enemy is my friend and all this. I don't feel like I have enemies, but sometimes out of loyalty to people, I will say not work with someone. This person really did something damaging to somebody I know, or something happened. And then out of loyalty to this person, like all of a sudden, I'm not going to be cool with that person. And this is something I'm struggling with now. This could change. This is something I'm learning and growing. I'm learning as we go. Then I find myself, because of my sense of loyalty, like I find myself in situations where all of a sudden there's like a lot of people that I feel like I can work with. And I'm starting to realize that not everybody does that. And so I'm trying to navigate like how to have clear relationships. And there's a lot of things that happen in the comedy circles and the comedy promotion circles. Comedians are weird. It's an individual endeavor. And there are very particular kinds of ways of thinking and behaving. We're quirky, and maybe everybody's quirky, but we put our quirkiness, like we wear it on our sleeves and we go on stage. We talk about these things, and then we deal with each other. But I'm trying to get to a point where I'm more accepting and more able to accept people where they are and not lose myself in the process, like still stand behind my own values and the work with the people that I want to work with, but also to understand that everybody's in a different stage of growth. Not everybody has been through what I've been through. In fact, no one on the planet has been through what I've been through or what you've been through. We're all growing, we're all learning. So I'm trying to practice a little bit more tolerance and empathy, and that's having some palpable effects on my relationships with people, especially people that I would otherwise find myself at odds with.
So if you were to do something differently today, if you were starting again, what would that, or in other ways, what mistakes are you learning from?
Differently. I probably would have started earlier. But I had a music career. I've done a lot of things, and I've only been doing comedy for the past, let's say, I started doing it 9 years ago.
Okay.
But I've been doing it for 6 years consecutively. I say the time between the first time I thought I should try this and actually trying it, if I could have changed that, would have been way shorter. This is something that you get better at over time. And I'm not a spring chicken by any stretch of the imagination. And I see some comics, there's this kid, Jack Nguyen, who's doing it now here in Saigon. And I've been doing comedy with him for the past 2 or 3 years. He started doing it when he was like 17. He's 19 now. Just murdering it. And I know he's going to get better and better at it. And so I really admire his courage and his strength. Especially he's a queer Vietnamese boy, and he's got all these challenges that he faces. And he just has the courage to get up there and say some wild shit. And I really admire him for that, because at 19, there's no way.
I don't even remember what I was doing.
You know what I'm saying? Jack, no pun intended. But to not allow myself to be able by fear or doubt, but otherwise, like, just everything happens in its time, man. Everything had to happen exactly the way that it, what did I learn from?
Yeah. From something you advise someone else starting out to do.
I stopped drinking before I go on stage. That was a big thing. So I feel like there was a lot of lost time just using alcohol as a means of managing my anxiety, and then sometimes getting through at night, it being okay, but learning much less from the experience because I wasn't tuned into what was actually happening in the moment. It would create like a buffer, and I have a joke about this also, but it would create like a space between me and the audience. And I thought that space was keeping me safe, but what it was actually doing was it was separating me from the audience and from the entire experience. So I just not really being present. And that was like maybe the first, within the first 2-3 years that, so it wasn't like I was like getting blackout drunk or anything like that, but it was just a certain like
form of escapism, right?
Yeah, this numbing that I thought was helping me because it's like this romantic thing. Yeah, I'm drinking and I'm getting on stage and saying all this crazy stuff. I really want to be there. I want to be able to be present and I want to feel the audience. And now that I'm doing that, like I'm at this place now where when I'm talking to an audience, it feels like I'm just talking to one person,
you know,
that is sometimes talks to me with different opinions and has like different heads popping up, but really being able to be present. And it's not that I don't drink, because I'll do a show and then I'll go and drink late to the night sometimes. That's the other thing. I could stay up later drinking because I have been drinking since 7 o'clock at night. So, yeah, just being more present. But no, in terms of, I'm learning all the time, man. There's always, every time I get on stage, there's something I've learned. The other night I got on stage, I did the open mic and I chanted a lot to just not use a lot of material and just do a lot of crowd work. And I was able to do it. It was really fun. And I think, and then I did end up using some jokes, but the crowd work, and when I say crowd work, it's talking to the audience and shooting the shit with them, finding out who they are and finding funny things about that. A lot of the crowd work worked even better than some of my favorite jokes. So just to be a little bit more fearless to, they say, what do they say? Like without a rope or without a parachute, but just being able to feel comfortable in that liminal space of, I don't know what's going to happen, but having faith that it's going to be okay. Yeah, so just to be a little more fearless. I wish
get there and practice, do the work.
Yeah. And that comes with practice. That comes with doing it again.
Absolutely. One last question. Is there any piece of advice for any kind of content creator that want to start today and they're still very hesitant? So it could be about YouTube, comedy, TikTok, writing a blog, whatever they want to create, but it's about their psychology and something is keeping them from just going and doing it. What would be you're talking to them now, what would be your advice?
Embrace fact. Fuck up. That you're gonna fail and that it's okay because we learn so much more from our failures than we do from our successes. If I have a great night, that's good in a way because people are laughing so hard and people are slapping me on the back and buying me drinks. Oh, that was awesome. And then, but all that's gonna happen is I'm gonna be floating on air for the next 3 days. And then my next show is guaranteed not going to go as well as that other one. Cause I'm like riding this tide of
high expectation.
And maybe I got a little bit full of myself and now I'm delivering the stuff differently or I'm more cocky. Like I did two shows and the first night I murdered, like I did so well and I was riding so high. I went to do this other show. And I showed up and I came on so strong with my first joke that everybody in the place hated me.
Wow.
And I proceeded to bomb. And I'll tell you the truth, I cannot remember the details of what happened with that show when I did really well. But I could tell you a 10-minute long story of what happened to me in the 5 minutes that I bombed because I learned from it. And it's funny because I see the person, there was a pair of women that performed right before me. They were doing music. It was an open mic for music and poetry, comedy, whatever. And they sang beautifully. It was lovely. And then I came on really strong, probably telling some shit jokes or whatever. And I see the woman all the time. And she says that she found it like hugely entertaining and she didn't think I bombed, but I know that I did. But that's there to be learned from. And one of the lessons I learned in that moment was meet the people where they're at. It's not about where you're at. It's not about you come in and you're just going to change the vibe of this whole place. Maybe I'll get there at some point, but I wasn't there then.
And don't take it too personally.
Don't take it personally.
Just a pig. It's, yeah, it's not you.
Yeah.
And we tend to do that as creators. We tend to take a lot of things personally.
Sure. Yeah, and catastrophize and make them worse than they are. But yeah, just embrace the fact that's going to happen. Like everybody you admire that's ever done anything at some point had never done it before.
Yeah.
And were as terrified as you are, more or less, and did it anyway.
Of this code, I don't know if you said it, but it's like most people who do well in public practice in private. It's like, we don't see the private stuff. We only see the facade, the public fame and all this stuff.
Sure.
But they had to do it sometimes.
Sure. That's like with bands. They'd be like, oh, they're rags to riches, overnight success.
Yeah.
Bullshit.
Overnight, man.
You know what I'm saying? That's why it's a little side note. So many bands will have amazing first albums. And then the second album, they call it the sophomore slump. It will not be as good because you had their whole lives to write their first album. Like all that culmination of all that experience, wisdom and artistry manifests in this first album. And it comes out and they're touring and the industry is like, hey, can you make another one of those like in a year and a half? And it's fucking no.
Yeah.
That's not how it works. But it's all that work behind the scenes, all that takes years.
Same with Joe Rogan recently. Some people said that it just came out of nowhere, but it's bullshit. It's like, if you look back at his catalog, it's like from 2010 or even before. So he's been doing it forever.
But also he's been doing, so that comedian that I told you about earlier, Bill Hicks, that basically saved my life. He was friends with Joe Rogan and he died in 94.
Well,
they did comedy together. That's how I actually met Joe Rogan.
Oh,
like years ago. It might have even been before he was doing the podcast. And the only reason I knew about him is because I knew that he was friends with Bill Hicks. And we sat down in the diner and he was super cool and we talked and stuff. But yeah, it's
looking forward to seeing you on Joe Rogan.
We'll see if that happens. Hey, you hear that, Joe? Coming for you, man. Coming to Austin. Coming to see you. But it's, and everything you do, whether on the outside of it, the finished product, whether it looks like a success or a failure, it's all a part of making you what you're going to be. So just take the steps.
And it's going to happen. JK, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Zach.
Real pleasure.
Cheers, man. Same here, dude.
Yeah. Thank you guys for listening and see you in the next one.
It stopped raining. Let's go outside.
Yeah.